Without any further delay, I would like to humbly invite our guest speaker for tonight, Hujjatul Islam wal Muslimin, Sayyid Agha Ali Raza from the Islamic Republic of Pakistan, who will be talking about the Quranic reconstruction of our intellects. Let's invite him with a salawat ala Muhammad wa Ali Muhammad.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Alhamdulillahi Rabbil Alameen. وصلى الله على محمد وآله الطيبين الطاهرين اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد لا سيما بقية الله في الأرضين روحي وأرواح العالمين له الفداء اللهم كن لوليك الحجة ابن الحسن صلواتك عليه وعلى آبائه في هذه الساعة وفي كل ساعة وليا وحافظا وقائدا وناصرا ودليلا وعينا حتى تسكنه أرضك طوعا وتمتعه فيها طويلا. Please recite the salawat. اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد. Today our conversation is going to start off a little strange. I'm going to suggest that each and every one of us, at least most of us, and most of humanity are suffering from a very particular ailment, a kind of a mental ailment, and most of us are suffering from this situation. And if I were to say this, most of you would be astonished, because obviously we know ourselves, and when we look at ourselves in the mirrors, we don't see people who are suffering from psychological ailments. But it is a kind of psychological ailment. And not only that, it is cross-cultural, it's universal, it's a true pandemic, and it's something that has existed throughout the ages for a majority of human beings. And strangely enough, most people seem to miss it. Most people seem to be oblivious about it. It is a kind of grand delusion, a communal delusion. In fact, a species-wide delusion. And it's been in humanity, era after era, and it is something that is kind of ingrained into our culture. And the interesting thing is that this is something which is common between the believers and the disbelievers. If you're using the term believers in the general sense, as the Quran does at many times. It is something that is in America, it's in Europe, it's in Asia, it's in Africa, it's in West Asia, or as the Middle East, as some people call it. In fact, throughout the world. What is this mental illness, to use a harsh word? What is this delusion? I would suggest that this delusion is something of this sort. We, in general, believe that we know how to think. We take it granted that we know how to think. And proof of this matter is that we never really seriously ask God for aql, for a higher level of intellect. We're not really ever worried about learning how to think in the proper fashion. Even some people who are educated and might have studied different types of subjects like logic, etc., they learn methods of thinking which are more traditional in nature. They're more conventional in nature. But they never turn towards religion. They never turn towards God and his book and the Ahlul Bayt to try to see whether our processes of thinking, our system of thought, at the very fundamental level, is it truly what God and the Prophet, salawatullah wa salamu alayhi, and the Ahlul Bayt want us to have? And as I said, if we introspect, me myself, and I'm obviously talking about myself, initially I'm talking about myself and obviously about all other people, even the people sitting here without any doubt, in fact, We've never looked into our own souls in the darkness of night, maybe at the early time of dawn, and thought, oh, I really don't know how to think. I don't know how to analyze things. I don't know how to look at the world and see it in the proper light, because I do not have that mental framework. And that in itself is proof. I mean, if we were to just ask ourselves this question right here, right now, how many times have we asked God seriously in that state of being really humble in front of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, asked Him to give us aqli saleem, a proper and steadfast intellect? Never. Almost never. Maybe when we're reciting some of the prayers and by chance there's a word there that says Allahumma razuqna aqlan saliman aw saliman aw amchun, and we just pass through that because, you know, we already have it. It's probably a prayer for other people to be taken seriously by other people, maybe the disbelievers, because the disbelievers, obviously, they do not have a framework which is taken from Islam and from Quran and from the Ahlul Bayt alayhim as-salam. But we're never ever looking at ourselves in this light. And that in itself is proof that we are deficient in this regard. Because when the Ahlul Bayt alayhim as-salam in their own prayers ask God for higher levels of intellect, then we who are not even worthy of the dust under their feet, we should be even more serious about this fact. So it is a pandemic. It's a pandemic which has been here from ages and from the beginning of time, in fact. And we don't take it seriously. We don't take it in the manner that we took Corona and we started creating vaccinations and then forcing people to get those vaccinations. And the interesting thing is that the vaccination for this particular disease has been sent by God Himself. It was the first vaccination created for a species-wide disease. And that vaccination, initially and in the most fundamental sense, is the Holy Quran. And obviously, the words of the Ahlul Bayt, alayhim as-salam, because these two cannot be separated from one another. But the fundamental constitution of Islam, the fundamental document of Islam, with it, that particular nature that that book has, is the Holy Quran. And if you look at it from this light, as we will, inshallah, briefly through the during this conversation, we will see how the Quran works to rectify and correct this intellectual problem that we all have. So step number one is to realize that we all have this problem. Many times when we are listening to speeches by the ulama, I'm obviously not a scholar in that sense, but when we're sitting in front of true ulama and we're listening to them, we commonly kind of deflect all of these issues towards other people. So we listen to them about tyranny and oppression, and we're never ever looking at ourselves. We're looking at other people, right? We're never looking at that small circle of influence that we have and where we might be the tyrants. I mentioned in the last speech that I had here, I think Ayatollah Jawadi Amoli, he said to a caravan that was going to Palestine in support of the Palestinian people, he said that if you want to fight the Israel that exists on the geopolitical scene, then you must start by fighting the Israel that exists within your own soul. Because Israel is transgression. It is transgression manifested, personified, which has come into being and embodied in the shape of a illegitimate state. And that is why the forces of Western new barbarism, Tawahhush-e Gharbi, as Imam Khomeini called it, they support this system because they want transgression, transgression against God, transgression against essential human values, transgression against a steadfast intellect which dictates that God be worshipped. They want this sort of transgression to become established within society, to become the norm. So when we resist Israel, when we resist the illegitimate Zionist state, we are resisting this fundamental change within worldwide culture. Some people kind of degrade this whole issue into a simple political tussle between nations or ethnicities. No, it is a fight for the very nature of the human soul, the very purity of the human intellect. So, as I said, step number one, look at ourselves. Now, step number two, why is a steadfast and pure intellect important? If we study the Quran and if we study the initial chapters of Usul al-Kafi, we will understand that the intellect has been created for the purpose of allowing us to worship God. And worshiping God is the only and exclusive path towards perfection of our own humanity, of our existential essence. So without a working and a proper intellect, without having a proper framework of thought, without having the proper tools for thinking correctly, we cannot achieve proper worship. And when we do not achieve proper worship, we are deficient in our move towards divine grace, towards that comprehensive prosperity that God has promised us. So, point number two, we need a proper working intellect in order to worship God, in order to be able to achieve comprehensive and holistic prosperity and success, which is, in fact, finafillah. So, now that we understand the importance of this issue, let us come back and see what point number three is. I'm trying to be very brief today because last time I kind of overstepped the time limit. Point number three is to understand how our intellect is corrupted. Cool. Now, this doesn't take some special environment. It doesn't take for you to be living in the West in that polluted social and cultural environment. Even within our most holiest cities, when we are born, we, according to the Quran, we are empty in terms of knowledge. Yes, we have certain basic programming, which is fitri, which is based upon our nature, that allows us to continue our existence in order to achieve the following steps that God has planned for us. But in terms of knowledge, we are empty, as the Quran testifies. And as we grow older, we learn. We learn essential values. As the Ahlul Bayt alayhimus salam, in their narrated traditions, they speak of the first 7 years to be the formative years of every child. In those 7 years, the essential values of the mind are created. And they are learnt most of the time, in the large bulk of it, they are learnt through seeing how their parents, their siblings, their fellows, their other children around them, and society in general is behaving. These values, they become the essential operating system of the mind. So, as an example, if a human being believes that stealing is something bad, right? But the amount of negative value that this has inside his psychology is less than the positive value of gaining some sort of interest, even if it is through illegitimate means. This internalized value system at a certain point of time will cause him to make wrong decisions, him or her to make wrong decisions. So, a more practical example. When we've had a late night, we've been out for cultural issues, maybe for mubahisa because we are here in Qom, or we've had classes, or we were teaching classes online. Anyway, we had a very late night. We were up till maybe 2 a.m. in the morning. Now, we know that Salatul Layl, because obviously I won't assume that Salatul Fajr gets qaza for any of the brothers. But we know that Salatul Layl is something that is highly recommended in Islam. Tahajjud, as brothers and sisters call it. We know that it is highly recommended in Islam. And then the consequences that the Ahlul Bayt have defined for this prayer, this particular namaz, are immense in terms of the spiritual risk, the spiritual sustenance. One of those things is the intellect and the growth of the intellect. In terms of these things, it is very important. The ulama say, if you want the world, Salatul Layl. If you want the hereafter, Salatul Layl. So everything is in that treasure hold. So obviously, in every religious man's and woman's mind, Salatul Layl is a positive value. Performing Salatul Layl is a positive value. But as Allama Iqbal, the great poet of Pakistan and the subcontinent, said, obviously if I translate it, then it's going to be destroyed. He says, "Humse hai pyar kahan neend tumhe pyar hai." You don't love us, God. He addresses human beings. He says, "You don't love me. You love your nightly sleep. You love your slumber, right?" So when it comes to making that decision, when the mobile starts ringing in the morning, and because we are religious people, obviously the alarm is something like Rabbana and things of this sort, right? Because we like that, right? So it starts ringing in the morning, and we say, Astaghfirullah, Ya Allah, be bakhshit. We're very sorry. We click the button and it's gone, right? We're going to have Namaz al-Fajr. Analyze why this decision was made, and then compare this to the fact that if your doorbell was ringing at the same time, something as mundane as that, I'm not even talking about an earthquake, the doorbell, it might have been a mistake. Someone might have done, because it's dark at night, right? Someone wanted to go to your neighbor's house and they rang your bell instead. But you'll get up, you'll get up, you'll go outside, you'll check. Even if there's a slight sound outside your house, oh, you think maybe it's a robber or something, right? And it turns out to be a cat prowling for food. But you get up. But Salatul Layl, nah, sorry God. I know all the sustenance is here, but maybe tomorrow. Maybe tomorrow, maybe the day after. And then for people like me, 38 years have passed. Maybe the day after. And then one day there, we find ourselves lying, facing the Qibla, people throwing dust upon our dead bodies. And we are still thinking, oh, maybe the day after. So the point is, the value system in our minds, obviously I simplified the whole psychological issue. It's much more complicated than that. But it's something called tazahum, right? And because many of our brothers here are students in the Hausa, it is a conflict between two pieces of positive values, right? And that conflict, that determines how you decide things. And it's not involuntary, it is voluntary. We're not talking about predestination, we're not talking about some robots who just work according to their operating systems. It is voluntary, but most of the time we do not have tawajjuh, we do not have attention towards taking a conflicting decision, taking a decision that goes against those internalized values that we have. So that was an example of how our values become corrupted. Even the most religious of our people, even people like students of the Hausa. Okay, so this is not something which has exceptions. Everyone at some level or the other is afflicted with this problem. So when we understand that this happens, and this happens throughout our lives, right? So the value system, first of all, is created through mimicking what people around us are doing, our parents, our siblings, our community. Then we are receiving contradictory narratives from different people. Like if you're living in a society which has different kinds of people, which every society is, right? You're getting different messages from society. You're sitting maybe after Eid someday and all of your relatives are joined together and you listen to an uncle saying, you know, education is the most important thing in life. If you don't have education, you won't be able to earn a good living. Right? And you are a kid, you're a youngster, you're a teenager. This is stored in your psychology, right? Then this message keeps repeating and that makes it stronger within your psychology. At the same time, you're receiving a contradictory message, maybe from a member. The scholar sitting there, he's saying, the most important thing in life is Iman, that is your faith. And risk, sustenance is from God. You just have to put in the effort in the halal way and he will give you. So this leads to what is called cognitive dissonance. Two different kinds of narratives within your mind, two different kinds of pieces of one operating system. If I were to give another example, it would be that of technology in our time, right? A mobile phone, a laptop. Consider, when do we say that a laptop is suffering from a virus? When is it polluted by a virus? When there is contradictory data, contradictory programming that has come into the laptop, and that goes against the internal logic of, for example, the Windows programming or the Apple programming or whatever, the Android programming in your mobile. Right? This internal conflict is called a virus when we're talking about technology. And little do we realize that we ourselves are afflicted with the same kind of virus. There are different types of narratives within our mind, different types of fundamental values within our mind, and they are conflicting with one another. And this is natural. I'm not blaming anyone for it. This is natural. When people are in society, they will interact with different kind of people. They will, in our time especially, because of social media, because of television, because of the internet, you will receive contradictory kinds of messages, and they will be stored into your subconscious. You can't filter them out. Even when you're looking at something and you're saying, ah, this is wrong, you're still receiving the message. Somewhere in your psychology, it gets stored. And we have so many, like, for example, just to make things, relate things to the narrated traditions of the Ahlul Bayt, Imam Ali alayhi salam, please recite the salawat. Allahumma salli ala Muhammad wa Ali Muhammad al-Faraj. Amirul Mu'mineen alayhi salam, he talks about looking at Namahram. So he says when someone, a teen, especially a youngster, when they look at a Namahram, it's like an arrow that has been released from the bow. Right? It will have its effect, even if you turn your face away. So you should be particularly careful in that regard. Let's take the same example and kind of expand it for all sorts of messages, all sort of data that you receive. The data will have its takwini, its existential, its... I don't know how to translate takwini, its physical effect upon your soul, even if you reject that data, right? So that gets stored somewhere inside you. And one of the reasons why we have this whole principle of nahi anil munkar, that even if you do not have the power to stop someone from doing wrong or saying something wrong, you should at least reinforce your own values within. Tell yourself, this is wrong. I am against this view. That provides you with some sort of a virus card against that message. Stops it from entering and storing itself in your hard drive within your psychology. And then influencing decisions later on when your guard is down. Right? So this is natural. This is natural. Now God, who created us, knew that this would happen. He knew that this would happen. And for this purpose, He sent for us before... We actually need, throughout the ages, He sent for us His message, His divine message. The most complete of those divine messages, the most pure of those divine messages, in fact, the absolutely pure of those divine messages, is the Holy Quran. And then when you look at the teachings of the Quran itself and the narrated traditions about reciting the Quran, you will find two messages being repeated over and over again. The first message is, God recommends that you read the Quran a lot, as much as you can. This is the exact translation of the ayah. As much as is comfortable for you. And obviously, it's depending upon your own common sense, right? Person like me would say, okay, how much is enough for me? How much is comfortable for me? Okay, Ramadan, 5 minutes before iftar. No, he's depending on my common sense. He's saying, I'm giving you medicine, but you're allowed to use it daily to your leisure. So obviously, it should at least be as much as some of the other tasks that we're performing for our dunya. And brothers and sisters, please realize our dunya here in the Hawza is our teaching and our learning and our lessons. We're not involved in like making high rises or buying and selling cars here, right? But our dunya is this, right? So if our normal class is 1 hour long or 50 minutes long, doesn't the Quran deserve at least the same value? So one of the messages that repeats itself over and over again is read the Quran as much as possible, as much as doesn't become counterproductive for you in the sense of making you uncomfortable and making you tired. And if you look at the practical examples of Imam Khomeini, of the other ulama, you will see how their lives were dedicated to Quran. So this is the first message that is repeated in the Quran and the narrated traditions of how to use the Quran itself. The second message is that the Quran and the narrated traditions of the Ahlul Bayt, they shun, they reject this superficial recitation that we normally have in society. Reading the Quran like a parrot does, not understanding what it says. They don't accept this to be something that should be normal. In fact, there are words like Allahumma inni a'uzu bika, the prayer of Imam Sadiq alayhi salam, please recite the salawat. Allahumma salakanga. His prayer, alayhi salam, about reading the Quran says, O God, I seek refuge in you. With these terms, I seek refuge in you from reading the Quran without pondering about it, without thinking about it, without contemplating its message. So sometimes, brothers and sisters, we are afflicted with a kind of religiosity that is, in fact, against our own religion. How strange and how sorry it is, and how truly it is a tragedy that sometimes people can spend the entirety of their lives thinking that they're religious, whereas they never troubled themselves to go and ask Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala and the Ahlul Bayt about what true religion was. Right? So, these two messages are repeated in the Quran and the narrated traditions. One, reading the Quran continuously, having a program in your daily lives, a plan in your daily lives for the Quran, giving the Quran the importance it deserves so that you do not become an instance of that ayah in the Quran which says that the Quran on the Day of Judgment will complain about those who threw the Quran behind their backs, who abandoned the Quran and its usability and its utility. So that is the first message that we have in the Quran and from the Ahlul Bayt. And the second is contemplation. We have this story from the traditions of the Holy Prophet sallallahu alaihi wa alihi wasallam. Please recite his salawat. Allahumma salli ala Muhammad wa ala Muhammad alayhi wa sallam. That after Ramadan, the Holy Prophet was asking his companions how much of the Quran they had read. And someone said that I read it 3 times, another one said 6 times, another one said 10 times, and so on and so forth. Then it came to Salman al-Muhammadi, Salman al-Farsi, Rizwanullah ta'ala. And the Prophet asked him, and he said, I just recited a few verses. And everyone was kind of snickering, making fun of him, right? And the Prophet asked, why did that happen? Obviously, he knew why it happened, right? But he wanted the other people to learn what Salman has and they do not. So Salman said that I spent the entire Ramadan thinking about these few verses that I read. And the Prophet said, this is the kind of recitation that we want, mafhoom-e kalam. Thinking about the Quran so that it becomes inculcated within your soul. We have this narrated tradition from the Ahlul Bayt alayhim as-salam. They say that when a youngster reads the Quran, and obviously they mean reading it in the proper manner, when he or she reads the Quran, it becomes part of his flesh, his blood, his bones, his very essence. If you translate this further, this youngster becomes a walking, talking Quran. Now you remember, when we say Quran al-Natiq, we are talking about the Ahl Bayt alayhimus salam, right? But then we have these other narrated traditions which say that the Shia of the Ahlul Bayt are from their teenath, from their essence. And the true Shia, obviously we are believers, but the true Shia are like the higher levels, the shuhada, the ulama, right? The true Shia, they are a toned down version of Quran and Natiq. They are themselves like their imams, similar to their imams, but at a lower level, because the path towards God is one path. Siratul Mustaqim, there's only one path. You're following the path of Amirul Mumineen. They're not parallel paths, that Amirul Mumineen has a different path, the Prophet of Islam has a different path, and you're like in another path. This is a concept of the Jews. They have the Gentiles, the others, and then the beloved nation or the higher nation. But in Islam, no, it's one path. It all goes towards Tawheed. So you're always behind the Ahlul Bayt, because it is from them that you're getting your spiritual sustenance. So you're always behind them. And then their progress is in light years, to say metaphorically. But you're in the same path, right? So this narration tells you that a youngster can become Quran and Natiq at a lower level, right? And we saw this. Like, this isn't something that is stories in our time. We saw this. Read the books about Sizda Saliha, the 13-year-old Shohada. Read the book called Arifane, I think it's called. That young child who was in Tehran, who used to pray, and his prayer would be between the roof of the mosque and the floor. He wouldn't be on the floor. And this is something that a mushtahid, I've forgotten the name of the alim, he witnessed himself. And then you had people like Ayatollah Jawadi Amoli, that when they visited the front during the 8-year war, they were sitting next to a young soldier, and this soldier wanted to, if I remember the story correctly, this soldier wanted to perform wuzu, but the place where there was water was within the range of enemy fire. But this child insisted. He said, I wanted to perform wazu. And all the ulama there, they tried to explain to him, this, you know, this tayammum is jais here. Tayammum is allowed. This is a situation in fiqh where tayammum is allowed. And he wouldn't answer. And in the end, he said, this is my last prayer. I want it through wazu. And then he just went off. And they thought, well, you know, it's just a child. He's emotional. And he prays. And then he returns safely. And then he's martyred. And if I remember correctly, Ayatollah Jawadi Amoli, he goes to his, because they brought the body back, and he goes to the body and he says, Jawadi dars bikhun, Jawadi falsafe bikhun, Jawadi usool bikhun, ina rasidan tu mundi. I can't translate this, inshallah. The brothers ask, those who don't understand Persian, ask the other brothers. So that is what a young child can become. That is the amount of energy that a child has. Now the Quran rectifies your thinking process, gives you the foundation blocks of thinking correctly, and allows you to make correct decisions in your life that lead towards comprehensive holistic success. Now just an example of how this happens. Conventional values and the conventional social system that we have, at many times, it just contradicts Islamic values. For example, look into our own lives. If someone approaches me right here, right now, and disrespects me, even at the slightest, right? Me with this garb and this, you know, amama, I come in here, and for example, someone sitting right next to the door doesn't say, Assalamu alaikum hajarahu. I somewhere within myself, I feel offended, right? This is impolite, you know? This is impolite. This boy hasn't learned etiquette in the Hoza. What is this? This is a crisis of the Hoza. Many of us are like this, right? We foreign start criticizing the Hoza. This is a crisis of the Hoza. The Hoza does not teach akhlaq, right? And then throughout Dua e Kumail, I'm sitting thinking about how to rectify the hawza. Right? But when you look at the Quran and the Sunnah, because this is one package, right? When I'm talking about the Quran, I'm talking about the entire package of the Saqalain, the two weighty things, inseparable. The Ahlul Bayt alayhimus salam, they tell us to practice this practice. Whenever we are talking about the Mu'mineen, they say, whenever one of the Mu'mineen somehow disrespects you or does something that is not favorable to you, اِحْمِلْ أَخَاكَ سَبْعِينَ حَمْلَةً. Bring into your mind 70, and 70 is adadul qasra in Arabic. Bring into your mind multiple excuses for that brother of you. And what is that? What is that practice for? It's for convincing yourself, right? It is an internal practice which is designed to rectify your internal value system, your internal operating system. It's like your antivirus working and saying, oh, I found 20 corrupted files and I have removed them. Right? When the Ahlul Bayt alayhimus salam, they tell you that you are not from amongst us if you do not do muhasiba before, accountability before sleeping at night. Right? This again is your antivirus working, trying to rectify your thought process. And as I said, many of our conventional values are of this sort. You must have heard if people who are living here, like, we have like a few bad incidents with our local brothers, and then we say, oh, you know, this nation, this is like this and like that. And we say the same thing about our own nations as well. Like, especially because I'm from Pakistan, whenever we talk about Pakistan, oh, Pakistanis are, you know, this and that. This colonial mindset that the British have placed into our souls. Right? So we're never doing husn-e-zan when it comes to our own brothers. But sometimes it's very strange. We do husn-e-zan about the enemies. I mentioned last time, like when you talk to people, when I go back to Pakistan, sometimes in my own extended family, I talk about how the new barbaric anti-civilization of the West, and at its helm, the United States of America, how they are the enemies of humanity, not just the Muslims, the enemies of humanity. And they look at you astonished. Americans, those, the leader of the Islamic Revolution said, some people think of them like gentlemen, they're so nicely dressed with their cologne and their perfume and always saying please and thank you. So, oh, see, this is, while the Quran, how stern is the Quran about people of disbelief? And we're not talking about common people. We're talking about the leaders, obviously. We're talking about those leaders of international Zionism who are the enemies of humanity in general. So, the Quran, I believe, and what I have understood from the works of the ulama, the Quran is a mechanism designed by God, designed by Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, which if used properly, will rectify, rebuild, reconstitute the very framework of your mind. But it requires for you and me to realize that we need this sort of rectification. May Allah allow us to use the Quran in the manner that it is truly designed to be used, and to rectify our minds and to rectify our thought process so that we may be able to worship God as truly is according to His pleasure. Wa sallallahu ala Muhammad wa alihi tayyibin at-tahirin. Allahumma salli ala Muhammad. Dua kana. اللهم عجل لوليك الفرج والعافية والنصر ومن علينا برضاه ودعاه واجعلنا وأولادنا وذريتنا جميعا من أحسن أوانه وأنصاره والمستشهدين بين يديه وإن لم نكن أهلا لذلك ولكن أنت أهل لذلك يا أكرم الأكرمين يا أرحم الراحمين اللهم احفظ قائدنا وعلماءنا الحق ومجاهدين في سبيل الله والثورة الإسلامية والمقاومة الإسلامية إنك على كل شيء قدير اللهم اغفر للمؤمنين والمؤمنات الاحياء منهم والاموات وداب بيننا وبينهم بالخيرات انك مجيب الدعوات اللهم اجعل واقب امورنا خيرا ربنا لا تقلنا على انفسنا طرفه عين ابدا اللهم صل على محمد وال محمد وعجل فرجهم.